We have asked for this hearing because with the transfer of the Alaska Railroad State ownership and because of newspaper accounts about concerns over herbicide and pesticide spraying in Alaska, not only by the railroad but by other entities and actors in the Alaska scene. We felt it from the standpoint of the Health Education Social Service Committee appropriate that the Senate obtain information about that, about these issues, and determine if or not legislation or budgetary changes are suggested by the fact that this hearing develops that. We have a teleconference network, and we may have testimony from persons outside of Anchorage. We've invited Senator Fahrenkamp, who will chair this committee, and the next week, who would like to chair this committee, to be represented in Juneau by staff. Senator Fahrenkamp is out of the state. But in any event, Senator Fisher and I will be reporting to our colleagues the results of this hearing and other information we are gathering on the subject. Is there someone here from the railroad? Is that Mr. Would you like to begin or have a statement to make? So I think it would help perhaps put us in focus if you would be here this week. If you just begin by giving your name, title, and then whatever comments on the subject generally from the railroad perspective, if you're appropriate.
Thank you, Chairman Senator Josephson. My name is Francis Weeks. I'm also known as Obie. I am the chief engineer of the Alaska Railroad. As of today, I'm a federal employee. As of Sunday, I will be an employee of the Alaska Railroad Corporation. Matter of fact, I just came from a meeting of the Corporation Board this morning. As far as where we are in the herbicide process, we have contracted with the Corps of Engineers, and I say we, the Alaska Railroad as a federal entity, to prepare an environmental impact statement. This was done through an agreement that allows for the Corps to provide services to other federal agencies. As we came close to the transfer time, the Corps says, as long as you're a federal agency, we can continue to work for you. However, when you're no longer a federal agency, something has to happen. To be able to get that issue cleared up, Mr. Turpin, as President and Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Railroad Corporation, has signed a memorandum of understanding to continue to proceed forward with the work as we are currently doing. So as of next Monday, the work that the Corps of Engineers is performing today for the Federal Railroad Administration branch of the Alaska Railroad, it will be continuing to be performed for the Alaska Railroads Corporation. And right now, I see no change in direction for where we're headed from that standpoint.
Is this an environmental impact statement or an environmental assessment?
The document that's being prepared right now is an environmental impact statement. We went through the environmental assessment, and as you're well aware, we're involved in a court battle. And in accordance with the Judge Vonderheide's ruling, we had to proceed with the EIS.
I'd like to acknowledge the President, Senator Patty Vaughn from the Southern Junction. One of the concerns I've heard expressed is that when the Railroad Corporation begins operations, we would no longer be governed by provisions of NEPA, which apply to federal agencies. Can you give me some enlightenment about that and to what degree the transfer will relieve the railroad of its environmental assessment or impact statement obligations that future activities?
You're correct in the state that NEPA only applies to federal actions. Is exactly how this is going to affect the Alaska Railroad operating under the Alaska Railroad Corporation, I'm not sure. Right now, we're proceeding as if no change had taken place, and that we are proceeding with the EIS.
I suppose the legislature could require that the railroad consider itself as if it were a federal entity for the purpose of NEPA. I'm not sure whether your board of directors has considered that, or would welcome that, or resist that, or object in principle to politicians saying the railroad is a business.
Yeah, you, as a legislative body, definitely could pass something like that. As far as saying what the board's reaction would be to the legislature meddling in the affairs of the corporation, I don't want to get involved in that one.
I might mention that Senator Lawson joined us as has been serving as the independent chair for the Committee of Transportation.
Have there been or do you anticipate any staff recommendations to the board of directors to move ahead with the use of herbicides since the federal regulations requirements will no longer apply?
There has not been anything happening in-house as far as making any recommendations to the board as far as this issue. Of course, with the publicity that has been in the papers, the... could you excuse me a second?
Is that a derailment or what?
I'd like to acknowledge the presence of Senator Tim Kelly in the river. Go ahead.
So as far as the change in the direction that we're headed, I really don't see any change. Of course, I personally believe that we do have a good program as far as what the herbicides, and I feel that we will be able to, after the completion of the documentation that we're working on, be able to continue with the program. And I don't really see any change due to the fact that we're no longer going to be a federal entity and part of the Alaska Railroad Corporation.
So that you personally do not plan to recommend any change of course pending the environmental effect statement?
To be honest with you, haven't really had time to figure out what direction to jump other than to proceed ahead as we are, because we're still currently under Judge Vonderheide's order, and not being an attorney, I don't know what the effect would be on the fact of that we do have the transfer, or what the judge would do if indeed a request went in.
Well, thank you. In the litigation in federal court, are there any claims in the light of the Transfer Act to which the state would have exposure, or does the Transfer Act turn them on? Require the federal government to hold harmless to the state for any liability arising from prior herbicide regulation?
I do not know of any claims that are involved in this. The litigation is, did the federal government, or the Alaska Railroad acting through the federal government, comply with NEPA?
Declaratory judgment, not a claim for monetary.
That is correct. But as far as the Transfer Act, I don't know if there was something come out of this where there was some costs involved, exactly whether that would transfer over the state or whether the federal government would pick it up.
Well, to your knowledge, is there any monetary claim pending, either formally or just through informal notice to the railroad arising from herbicide spraying activities?
Not from the spraying activities themselves. Of course, when you're involved in the court action, there's a claim for legal fees involved. But other than that, I don't know of any other claims.
I'd just like to make a comment. I think that anything that the federal government got themselves involved in and screwed up, the state's not going to pay for it. It's a case. In all the hearings that we had, I don't recall any case, Mr. Chairman, of us being faced with a possible funds that we've got to pay out of or whatever due to something caused by the herbicide. I don't know of any cases that would be damaging on other than perhaps legal fees, and that would be the federal government's bailiff.
One thing that would be in your province, as I remember, there was some issue as to whether there were other ways to clear the right-of-way besides the use of the herbicide. And the controversy was back as to whether there were other commodities that could be less controversial in some certain purposes. Would you enlighten me as to what that's about? Whether you know of any such substances or alternatives?
I might explain that as far as our herbicide program, there are two portions to the program. There's two types of vegetation that we're trying to control in two different areas related to the track. The one is the area that's in the ballast section, the middle 20 feet of the track, which we're trying to completely defoliate the track section. The other is outside of the ballast section, where you're trying to control the tall vegetation, i.e. the brush. And as far as how you attack the two, you have to look at them individually. The brush that's outside the ballast section, we spray, we use mechanical cutters, we use dozers, we use hand labor, and in the past we've used combinations of all four of those to be able to control the brush. As far as the vegetation in the middle of the track, there is, as far as I'm concerned, basically no substitute for the herbicide in the middle of the track. There are some things that you do with the track and normal track maintenance that will reduce the amount of vegetation in the track as you're dumping ballast, going through and raising the track. I think that one of the things that you were alluding to was, is it a viable option to have local citizens go up and physically pull the weeds from the track to defoliate it? Looking at it from a legal and safety standpoint, I see some great problems in that area.
You mean that the individual volunteers might get hurt, or
yes, the conflict between the people in the track and the train operation. We, of course, frequently have citizens, namely contractors in the middle of the track, various highway projects that are working with utilities, and we do have problems with them, and we have very strict safety requirements on that operation.
I see no other questions. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Now I'll turn to William W. Mitchell. And you identify yourself to your organization.
My name is Bill Mitchell. I'm a professor of agronomy with the Agriculture and Forestry Experiment Station. I'm located at Palmer, the Palmer Research Center. I really wasn't sure of the gist of this hearing, but I presume that it would be concerned with the safety of use of certain herbicides, and particularly those that are called the phenoxy herbicides, because they are the ones that attract the most attention. Though I'm not a chemist or a weed scientist, my work does involve the use of herbicides, and because I am using them myself, naturally I am concerned with the safety of their use and their effect on me. And I have therefore looked at the literature, looked at the work that other scientists have done with them, those who know much more about herbicides than I do, and I looked at the results they have obtained. Now, I brought with me several items that I would like to deposit with the committee that have a bearing on the subject. I have to keep pressing it if I take it.
Or you can lock it in.
Just like that. That's much better. There was a Council for Agricultural Science and Technology that engages in studying various issues, and whenever they do, they call upon, of course, experts in their particular fields, and they have put out a report on the phenoxy herbicides that I will leave with the committee, and it reviews the uses of these herbicides and their effects and their judgment as to their safety. This is a a publication put out by an Oregon researcher. And of course, they're concerned a great deal with forestry there and brush control and forestry. And this is one called Chemical Brush Control Assessing the Hazard. This is another one by the same author, Behavior and Impact of Some Herbicides in the Forest. This is a statement of the Society of Range Management that was issued regarding the use of 2,4-5-T, which is one of the herbicides that's used mainly for brush control. And I'll read the summary of their statement. It says, the Society for Range Management supports the continued production and currently registered uses of 2,4-5-T and related products. Although many questions about this herbicide's safety have been surfaced through news reports, the news media have failed to report the preponderance of reliable scientific research which clearly and conclusively documents the safety of 2,4-5-T. This vast body of scientific evidence demonstrates that 2,4-5-T poses no harm to humans, wildlife, or any other forms of animal life as it is presently manufactured and used. There was a study conducted in Arkansas, and this is with the people actually applying the sprays, those who mixed the sprays, those who applied the sprays with backpack sprayers, so the spray was in close contact with the body, and aerial applications. And they looked at the amount of the herbicide that was actually taken up by the body and excreted by the body. And of course, some of it does enter the body system, but it's excreted rather rapidly. And their conclusion was that had the crewmen been exposed to over 300 times more than they were actually exposed to, that they still would not have experienced any harmful effects.
Bill, many years ago I was a pilot and we used aerocyanamide as defoliant for defoliated cotton. Is there any similarity between what you're speaking about here and the old aerocyanamide that we used as defoliant back in those days, maybe 25, 30 years ago now? We used it for cotton defoliant, but it was terrific. And I noticed sometimes we had some dripped over on apple orchards, and it made a much easier for apple picking. And I just wanted it, and we got enough of that stuff on us, but we never had any effect on it. I don't think it ever affected
us. I'm not familiar with it, Senator. Sorry.
Yes, Senator Boss. Is there anything you can do to Agent Orr?
Well, I'm not sure.
Now, the Agent Orange is one of the... it's a form of the 2,4-5-T. But there is a great difference between Agent Orange and 2,4-5-T as it is used today, or has been used since the Vietnam War. There is a contaminant in 2,4-5-T called dioxin, or PCDD. It is a very poisonous chemical. And the amount present in Agent Orange is much greater than that which is present in the current products called 2,4-5-T.
You cited several studies.
Yeah.
In your review or research, did you find any studies contrary to that?
I haven't, no. Not those conducted by the scientists in the field. The next item is one concerning a happening in Australia, the state of Victoria, where there was, during this one period, 1975 to 1976, there were a number of abnormal births. And this was in a region where they habitually sprayed with 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T. And therefore, the finger was pointed at these herbicides as the possible cause. And therefore, this council was gotten together to study the issue. And there were 12 members on the council. The council included such people as the chairman of the Poisons Advisory Committee, chief of the Division of Agricultural Chemistry, the chief chemist, pediatricians, virologists, veterinarians, dean of pharmacology, the Victorian College of Pharmacy, And their unanimous conclusion was that the cluster of babies with first effects born in Yarm in 1975 to 76 was not such as to suggest that a specific local cause was operative. Analysis of all information available showed no evidence that these birth defects were caused by exposure to 2,4-D or 2,4-5-T. The normal agricultural use of 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T has not been shown to cause birth abnormalities in domestic animals, nor is there evidence to connect such use with human birth abnormalities. More recently, there was a case brought before the Supreme Court of Nova Scotia in which the plaintiffs attempted to stop the use of 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T in that province in Canada. The Supreme Court heard this case and they came out with a 182-page decision. Justice D. Merlin Nunn wrote, and this is the essence of the decision, "I am satisfied that the overwhelming, currently accepted view of responsible scientists is that there is little evidence that for humans, either 2,4-D or 2,4-5-T is mutagenic or carcinogenic, and that TCDD is not an effective carcinogen, and further, that there are no effect levels and safe levels for humans and wildlife for each of these substances." This item is out of the Crops and Soils magazine produced by the Agronomy Society. The most recent report that I became aware of was a review of the available scientific data by two Oregon State University researchers, John Walstead and Frank Dole. And I just became aware of that within the past 2 weeks, and I phoned and asked if they send me a copy. They mailed it, but I didn't receive it. But I will read you a statement from their conclusion. It says, "Without exception, the amounts of herbicides detected in the environment have been far below the known levels of toxicological significance to humans, fish, wildlife, and livestock. As a consequence, it is not surprising that there have been no substantiated cases of direct adverse health effects to humans or animals when these materials have been used properly in agriculture and forestry. This bulletin has been based on the most authoritative reviews of which we are aware that evaluate the risk of using herbicides. These evaluations have been remarkably consistent in their determination that registered herbicides are safe to humans, wildlife, and livestock when used as directed. This finding is reassuring in light of the important role that these materials play in sustaining the productivity of agriculture and forestry." When I receive that copy, I will send it to the committee. To reiterate, I handle herbicides and other pesticides personally, and therefore I am concerned for my own safety. With all the evidence now at hand on the effects of herbicide use, I am convinced that they are safe to use. Of course, a user should not be careless any more than a person should be careless driving a car or crossing the street, which are probably more dangerous undertakings than the use of pesticides. Without the use of chemicals, our farm products necessarily would be much higher priced. Some of our producers would likely be priced out of business. As for the control of brush, chemical control can be a valuable tool. It is less expensive than mechanical control and more lasting in its effects. Over some terrain, mechanical control can be very difficult, even impossible and dangerous. Lastly, I see the usefulness and safety of bike trails diminished by the growth of brush that limits visibility and threatens the structure of the trails. I think the judicious use of chemicals to quell the growth of brush would improve their safety.
Thank you, Professor. Are there any questions? I appreciate your comments.
Okay.
Is Judith Griffin back here? Are you jointly agreeing with Ben Ray?
First of all, thank you for giving us the opportunity to appear here before the committee. We're speaking on behalf of not only our own family, but about a dozen other families in Anchorage as well. who have all been directly exposed to unwanted pesticide spray during the past two summers. Our immediate concern, then, is the exposure to these potentially hazardous chemicals in our own home environments. These chemicals may be EPA registered, however, this registration does not assure their safety or verify their safety. All of these chemicals are toxic, and what we are seeking is the establishment of strong guidelines to assure minimal exposure to them.
There are two sides to this question which we're concerned with. Number one, we want a greater physical safety for our children and ourselves in our home. And two, we want to live in an environment free from the emotional stress caused by the worry that these hazardous chemicals give us. And I've identified these two sides to it, one the physical and one the emotional, but they're inseparably one pain to us as parents. It's stressful enough to be a parent and raise a kid to adulthood and self-sufficiency and relate to those demands of parenthood without having the additional burden of worrying about being poisoned in our own home. And it's not a question of is there a risk or no risk. There are either risks or there are unknown risks. And it's for those two reasons, the physical safety and our own emotional well-being, that we're concerned and we're here today.
I'd like to relate briefly the experience that prompted our involvement in this issue. It was mid-morning, July 3rd, 1984. It was a gusty morning, but warm enough that our windows and doors were open, and I was just preparing our children to go outdoors to play. At this point, a pest control truck drove up in front of our home and parked there, and the applicator, a young man in an open raincoat, immediately began preparations for spraying in our next-door neighbor's yard. We literally just had enough time to close our doors and windows when the high-pressure spraying of two large birch trees began. Even in the absence of a wind, our property would have been subjected to the spray, but as it was, clouds of the spray rained down upon our home, our yard, our children's toys, and our garden, which had just reached a harvestable stage. When we confronted the pesticide applicator after he had finished spraying, he responded that it was, quote, just a systemic, end quote, called medicine stocks, and that if we hosed down the toys in the garden, there would be no danger. Whether he lied or was misinformed about the dangers of the substance, we don't know. However, upon consulting with both the Cooperative Extension Service and the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, we were advised to eat nothing from our garden for a full 3 weeks. Our initial emotional responses, of course, were horror and shock. After that, anger and depression took over for about the next couple of weeks. But the only thought more frightening to us than what we had actually witnessed happen to our yard and garden and home environment was the fact that had we not been there, we would not have witnessed what had happened, and we may never have been aware of the contamination of our property and our garden. We feel that the threat to our family's health and safety would certainly have been very great.
And this is where the oneness comes in for us that I talked about with the two sides. And it's not only for their immediate physical state, but it's the future that we're concerned about, and that's what causes us to worry. In dealing with these hazardous chemicals, such as the pesticides, we got the following questions, and this is the residue of the abuse that we live with and we're concerned about, is how individually susceptible are each of our children to this? Is there something that, as one of our kids slipped through the statistics and the research, and is susceptible because of some unknown reason? In a later illness at a time that because other factors in the environment that this is going to play some insidious role. Do these poisons interact with other chemicals in our environment? And is there a synergistic effect that's going to have a negative impact on their lives? Testing of these chemicals does not answer those questions. And our involvement worked out in terms of getting together with other individuals that had also experienced pesticides being applied to their homes, children, pets, yards, gardens, and in two instances themselves. We found that the department here in Anchorage, the Department of Health and Environmental Protection, had received an increased number of complaints during the summer of 1984, of which we were one. And we started collecting names of individuals, and without very much effort, collected a name of 12 people, and we call ourselves Safe Home Environments. The department was concerned about getting a handle on the abusive practice of pesticides in Anchorage, they had taken initiative to write an amendment to the pesticide ordinance here in Anchorage that would regulate the use of pesticides. This was done, a meeting was called of pesticide applicators, state horticulturists, pesticide expert, health professionals, and a couple of individuals like ourselves were concerned, parents and citizens. I had come with the idea that we were going to talk about the regulations, but the pesticide applicators themselves suggested a compromise, and they proposed a ban on spraying pesticides above 4 feet. And as one individual, a individual that had been in business in pesticide industry here in Anchorage for in the neighborhood of 20 years, I'm not sure, but a significantly long time, said it's the way of the future, and if we don't go with it, then we're just going to be out of find ourselves out of business. They said there's many other ways of applying pesticides and dealing with the problem besides spraying. And so the city is in the process now of writing a new ordinance or a new amendment that bans the spraying of pesticides in Anchorage, and that will be introduced to the Anchorage Assembly on February 5th.
Okay. During the course of the development of this amended pesticide ordinance, we were both very much struck and impressed by the broad base of support that this ban was getting, as Glenn mentioned, from everyone from the pesticide applicators themselves to health professionals to horticulturists to citizens in the community. And I think this is very significant on a statewide basis as we consider the level of widespread public concern over the risks versus the benefits of pesticide application and an increased awareness of the need for a safe and viable alternative to this. This amended ordinance may provide protection on a local level right here in Anchorage, but only really touches the tip of the iceberg when we consider, providing solutions to broader concerns about hazardous chemical usage within our environment. Concerns about soil contamination of well water, streams, for example, from the use of chemicals directly into the soil. Our own energy thus far has been directed toward one small local issue, but these broader issues must be also addressed.
And on behalf of our children and the families in safe home environment and what I imagine to be a much larger body of concern, we'd like to suggest three things to this committee to be considered for future legislation. Number one, regulate the pesticides sold in Alaska, allowing only those with a minimum risk to people and the environment, and that minimum risk would have to be carefully looked at and defined. Number two, formulate state guidelines on pesticide application and ensures minimum risk to people and the environment. So number one, the chemical, and number two, how to use the chemicals that are allowed in a safe way. And number three, fund some research on the effects of hazardous chemicals such as pesticides in our environment, with particular emphasis to how these hazardous chemicals work into our drinking water and impact marine life. And thank you very much for the chance of testifying.
Well, Professor Mitchell, who preceded you, was talking about the application of herbicides and agricultural situations. Get any comfort from them?
Well,
or do you think it's a different problem with pesticides in urban areas?
No, I don't. I don't think it is. I'm relieved to find that there is a body of research that says that the certain of these chemicals are safe for certain things, but there is no research that says any of these chemicals are safe in all categories. And they're not talking about no risk. They are talking about a level of risk, it's the fact that these are poisons, and they entail risks and unknown risks. It's not that I'm relieved to find out that that there is some assurance in some categories, but it doesn't leave me feeling that the chemical is still okay for all things. Or is there a cumulative effect? Does this build up in the environment? The professor mentioned that there still needs to be safety concerns on application. There's still a danger involved.
I have some information from a Chemical and Engineering News of March 12, 1984, which shows that of more than 3,000 pesticides, that more than 60% have minimal to no toxicity data available whatsoever, and that in only 10% of the cases is there a complete assessment on these particular pesticides. So I think we are really playing a very risky game in the use of them, and we must consider restricting them.
Do you have a copy of the Anchorage ordinance in draft form?
Right now it's in the attorney's office, a man named Michael Marsh.
Marsh. Mm-hmm.
I believe it has not been written. Dr. Wilson from the
has sent a memo requesting that to be put in terms that can be presented to the Assembly on February 5th, but I'll be happy to send that to you. It should be done hopefully within the week.
I would like to copy that. And what kind of pest control would be tolerable or permitted after the enactment of the ordinance that you send it out?
There would be root applications, which has been talked about. There has also been some talk about apparently a substance that can be painted on the bark of the tree, although it's not, I don't believe it's legal here to be able to do that, but that there are other options. We're not really aware of all the options that exist. We'd like to know more about them. We'd also like to have them studied, for they're also, how do they get into the soil, how do they work their way into water systems, that sort of thing. This, as we said, this is just the tip. This will regulate the broadcasting of a pesticide in a wide area, but there are other issues to be addressed.
The applicators alluded to dozens of options that they had, but only talked in detail about one, which was the application of a systemic directly into the soil around the base of the plant.
Another question? Yeah, how about mosquito spray? You know, we have to do a lot of bothers sometimes. Is that considered also?
That was a large controversy in California over the those flies that I forget what the name of it, the med fly, food fly. Honestly, Senator Moss, I don't know where I'd stand on that. We're not taking a position just totally against chemicals. We're taking a position for safety and well-being of our families, and I can't give you a yes or no answer on that. I just don't. I don't have any strong feelings that I could just blurt out one way or the other.
The reason I ask the question is because I know that in a lot of areas in the state, sooner or later, the things that occur in Anchorage will be considered in other areas. And I think that I remember reading an article one time, there's more protoplasm and mosquitoes that we've got in the state than we have in all the caribou walking around. It kind of worries me at the time when I think about those mosquitoes. Fogging, for example, is quite used extensively in the Fairbanks area. I'm not quite aware of how much it's used in the Anchorage area, but I'm sure that on occasion it could be used.
I'm not aware that it has been used, at least during the time that we've been here. I think a lot of what we're saying has to be considered, though, is to look at the real risk of pesticide to the human who is being exposed to it.
We just don't want the risk of having the cure worse than the ill.
Right.
No, thank you very much for coming forward. Before I forget this, is the railroad herbicide in the 2,4-D, 2,4-5-T family? I'm not sure what these mean, but just for our record, what is the compound that's sprayed?
We're using Codon 101 and 109. That's a combination of 2,4-D and Tecora.
We were using Tordon 101, which had 2,4-D in it, and when we got into the legal battles, one of the things that Judge Bonderheide did was stopped us from spraying the 2,4-D in 1983.
I apologize to those of you who are experts in this, or more knowledgeable than I am, which is probably all of you, but was there testimony before Judge Bonderheide or reports indicating that these compounds were toxic or harmful to humans, as opposed to the literature that the professor gave us today?
Yeah,
the scientific dispute will come out in the testimony later. I assume the judge had something in the record to warrant that kind of injunction, or at least he thought he did.
Yes, there was considerable testimony and documentation regarding the various chemicals, and we were at that time using three chemicals, of which Tordon 101 was one. And since that time, that we have looked at the effects or the possible effects on one of the chemicals that we had been using, and in the documentation we had in the EA, we no longer have that as part of our program.
So you're using what
now? At the minute, we're not using anything due to the court order. But we were using Bromosil and aminotriazole until in the summer of 83, which the one we have now dropped out.
So what is the way, how do you control weeds in two areas?
series we talked about under the corollary, you know, that had put upon me.
In the summer of 1984, we did no chemical application on the weeds. As far as what happened in the track section, the railroad became much greener this year. We lost ground as far as our maintenance program. Spraying weeds in the track is kind of like changing oil in your automobile engine. You can get by for a while without changing the oil, but pretty soon something's going to happen and you're going to start to deteriorate your track structure. So in 1984, there was no spraying in the track. The areas where we dumped ballast, which is not an effective method of weed control as far as if you're trying to control weeds solely, but it did. That was the only place where we did have any vegetation control in the middle of the track. As far as outside of the track area, in the brush, we used a mechanical cutter and also dozers and a little bit of hand labor in very selected spots.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is Guy McConnell here?
I'm Guy McConnell with the Alaska District Corps of Engineers. I've been working as part of my duties for the last 2 years with the railroad on their vegetation management program. I prepared the environmental assessment that was done earlier this year, and I'm working now on the documentation for the remainder. You asked before, earlier, about herbicides. There are, 130 or 140 that I know of. There's a very wide range of these chemicals. And in accepting public comment and comment from the agencies in this matter, I've come across several misconceptions that are widely perceived. And I'd like to talk a little bit about those, the three areas in particular. One is the concept that herbicides are a discrete chemical group of themselves. Another misconception regards the toxicity of the herbicides. And three, in the exposures that you're likely to receive of herbicides. First of all, the herbicides as a group, common misconception that they are chemically similar, and they are not. The only shared characteristics among these 130 or 40 chemicals is that they all affect the growth of plants. They're marketed in more than 1,000 formulations. They include both organic and inorganic compounds based on petroleum, natural gas, and a variety of other chemical feedstocks. They have a wide range of chemical characteristics in their solubility, the way they break down in the environment, how long they last, and the way that they act in living organisms, both plants and animals. In the herbicides, we find a wide range of substances as chemically different as aspirin is from rocket fuel. This is significant for two reasons, this concept. First, because they represent different chemical groups and different chemical characteristics, you can't judge one chemical or one herbicide by another. If, for example, you found that you didn't want to use 2,4-5-T, or you felt that Asian Orange was proven bad, this doesn't mean that you should kick out the other 130 or 40 chemicals. They're very different. You have to consider them separately. To do that would be about as valid as saying that you don't like 2,4-5-T, so give up using mosquito repellent. They're as different chemically from each other as 2,4-5-T is from mosquito repellent. Or as asbestos is a hazardous insulation, so you should ban fiberglass. Because they're, again, the chemical similarity is, or differences are that great. Secondly, there's no valid reason to assume that herbicides are any more or less toxic to humans and animals than many other functional groups of chemicals, including wood preservatives, paints, solvents, synthetic detergents and cleaners, motor fuels and lubricants, insecticides and other pesticides, waxes and polishes, rubbing alcohol, automobile antifreeze, and so on. These other petrochemicals and many chemicals that we use every day. The point here is that the fact that an herbicide kills plants has nothing to do with whether or not it will affect animals, including humans, and there's little rational basis for avoiding all herbicides while continuing to use these other chemicals. A rational decision should be based on evaluating chemicals individually rather than on the basis of whether or not they are herbicides. The second misconception, major misconception, was in the toxicity of herbicides. We've all heard that these are highly toxic materials. I'd like to point out that toxicity can be expressed in a number of ways. In one way of expressing it, it's how much of a chemical it takes to kill half of a population of laboratory animals in a single exposure. In another way of expressing it is how much of it does it take to make you sick or to show effects physiologically in these lab animals and in a single exposure. And in a third way is expressed in its potential to cause long-term or illness from long-term exposure to small amounts, these chronic exposures. When we describe something as highly toxic, most of us think in terms of potential from lethal dosage from a single exposure. To put things in perspective, strychnine or cyanide or arsenic or the things that we think of as being strong poisons will kill in the range of 1 milligram per kilogram of body weight, or in other words, about a millionth of your body weight will kill you. This means that in the range of a few drops, it's poisonous, highly poisonous. EPA talks about chemicals as being highly hazardous if they're lethal in the range of from a few drops to a tablespoonful, 1 milligram per kilogram to 50 milligrams per kilogram. As we go to the milder chemicals, nicotine also falls in this general range. The less toxic chemicals we run into, caffeine is in the range of 200 milligrams per kilogram is lethal. Aspirin is lethal at about 1,000 milligrams per kilogram. Table salt at about 3,000 milligrams per kilogram. Grain alcohol at around 7,000 to 10,000 milligrams per kilogram, about 1% of your body weight, will pretty surely do you in. A lot of the chemicals we use around the house, motor fuels and so on, fall also into this range, or at least would make you terribly sick in this range of 200 milligrams to 10,000 milligrams, or about a shot glass to about a pint and a half, would be for a person of about 165 pounds. The way herbicides fit into this, most of the commonly used herbicides commonly used in the open environment, that's outside of fumigation and greenhouses and that sort of thing, fall into the range of 350 milligrams to 10,000 milligrams or more to produce an LD50 and kill half a population of lab animals. So they fall into this same general range of many of the commonly used chemicals that we encounter. We come then to the concept of sickness from a single dose or short-term exposure, and this varies widely among the herbicides. There's no way to generalize about it except to say that most of the herbicides commonly used, there's a threshold level for a short-term exposure to cause sickness. The body has ways of excreting and eliminating this material. Excuse me.
Mr. McConnell, let me ask you a question about this. Maybe you can explain why you're doing it. Is there a cumulative effect on this 2,4-D, 2,4-T that we're talking about here that would have a bearing on what we're trying to consider here?
Okay, sir.
In other words, you get so much lead in your body, you can get rid of it in a period of time or what have you. In other words,
I think you certainly would have to consider cumulative effect. And this can occur from two different ways. In chemicals that are carcinogenic, it appears from research that they are hit-and-run chemicals, that if you are exposed to carcinogens over a period of time, even though the chemical itself may leave your body, the effect of the chemical may remain. This is for carcinogens and mutagens, things that cause cancer in particular. The others, if the chemical leaves, the effect seems to go away unless there was some permanent damage done to an organ. Now, the question that you are asking is, does the chemical remain? Lead remains in our body if we ingest it a certain amount. So does mercury and so on. And it's a very valid question. One of the biggest problems with DDT and its metabolites, its degradation products as they break down, are that they do tend to remain in fatty tissue in the body and can continue to cause problems over a long period of time because of that. In the chemicals that you've asked about, 2,4-D, 2,4-5-T, they have done laboratory tests in a number of different places, both with humans and with animals, that show these chemicals, both of them, are rapidly eliminated from the body without being metabolized. They're eliminated in the same chemical formulation that they come in and are not used in the body unless the body is oversaturated with them. If you reach a certain level, the body loses its ability to excrete them as fast as they're coming in. It takes quite a large amount to do this. I should say, however, that there are impurities, dioxins, in both 2,4,5-D and 2,4-D in extremely small amounts. The dioxin in 2,4,5-T is quite poisonous, although it is extremely small in amount. The dioxin in 2,4-D is much less poisonous than 2,4-D itself, and is also an extremely minor contaminant. Both of these materials, the dioxins, because of their chemical nature, are tended to be retained by the body for a longer period than the basic chemical itself. Did that answer your question? Yes, sir. So in speaking of the short-term exposure, single-dose short-term exposure, if the level is small enough, the body tends to cast, in general, and I'm speaking in general of these 130 or 40 chemicals, the body tends to eliminate these chemicals as long as they are below a threshold level. If you exceed that level, you can cause sickness, damage to the body. As I say, these are all very different. There's a huge body of information about these effects. The US EPA has literally hundreds of people working to evaluate potentially toxic chemicals and doing nothing but that full time. And there's a tremendous body of data on this. If you want to know more about it, the best thing to do is treat these chemicals as individuals and contact the experts to find out about these particular problems.
One exposure and that question put to you, but as I understand it, in the railroad situation, you have some people who have elected to live along the rail line, pursue a rural lifestyle, perhaps do berry picking or other subsistence or recreation activities using the track or right of way that has a clearing or a pedestrian transportation route. And of course, it is an attraction, I assume, to children in those areas also. Assuming those facts, hypothetically at least, would that be one exposure or a series of exposures which could have some negative health implications for those people pursuing that lifestyle?
Okay, sir, we studied that. In preparing the environmental assessment for the railroad, what we looked at there was from two angles. One, first of all, is the basic toxicity of the chemicals themselves. How toxic are they if you get a certain amount, take a certain amount into your body? And then the second question was, how much would you be likely to take into your body if you were exposed to them through these various routes? We worked up I hesitate to call it a worst-case analysis because that's such an ambiguous word, but we put together calculations of how much a person would receive if they were to go out right behind the railroad spraying the right-of-way, were picking berries right behind it, went to a stream right next to the track, a slow-moving body of water next to the track, and drank water from that, assuming that the railroad had made a mistake and applied directly on the water, which they do not do as a normal practice. And if they were to take a fish out of that water and eat it right away, take milk from a cow that had been fed on this vegetation, and use this as sort of a worst-case way to find out how much chemical these people would get. What we came up with was, first of all, that it depends on the chemical you use, because you use different amounts of them, and they have different characteristics on the plants. But that in a worst-case exposure, you were getting, on the day of the herbicide application itself, you might take up a quarter to a half a milligram per kilogram of body weight. Now, this is if you did all these things in the same day. And then after that, the amount of chemical that you would take up through this route, would doing each of these things, would rapidly decrease as these chemicals degraded, went into the soil or whatever. Over a year's time, there would be potential for small amounts, for small exposures. Or if you were to go right next to the track, say, and drink water from a stream right next to it, you might get in the part per billion range of these herbicides. To relate that to what you see in your normal environment, if you drank, all say, 250 gallons of water in a year, and it had one part per billion of 2,4-D in it, you'd get about as much 2,4-D as you would get if you went down to the store and bought one apple with legal limits of 2,4-D in it, but it might legally have in your produce tank, and eat that one apple, you'd get about the same amounts of 2,4-D.
Part of your function in doing the impact statement is to consider options for the railroad. That is, whether there are alternatives that would be efficacious but not present whatever environmental problems or hazards are alleged to accompany the spraying. Can you comment on that as to whether you even think of options and alternatives?
Yes, sir. Under the NEPA, National Environmental Policy Act, you're required to review, first of all, the public concern in the matter, and secondly, the full range of alternatives to meet a particular problem. We received comment and examined a number of alternatives. As Mr. Weeks was saying earlier, the railroad uses a number of means to control vegetation at this time, and has before, although they rely principally on herbicides. I contacted a number of railroads in the lower 48 to see what they were using, and also in Canada. I could find no railroad in the United States or in Canada that did not use herbicides as the mainstay for vegetation control. There are a number of things that can be done. As with many engineering problems, it's not whether it's engineering feasible, it's how much does it cost. Mr. Weeks pointed out, in reballasting, you get rid of some of the weed problem. You can do a certain amount of clearing of brush by hand. I was not able to find anyone in the industry or in the scientific community who could suggest ways of that seemed feasible to control vegetation on the roadbed to meet railroad objectives without the use of herbicides. That doesn't mean that either the state or the railroad or whoever shouldn't continue to look for methods. I really believe that we should try an integrated approach to any kind of pest problem. But I couldn't find anyone that had solved this problem without herbicides. Well, we got suggestions from all a number of different areas. Suggesting we use salt water, for example, suggesting that we cover the tracks with an impermeable material all the way along for the whole 600 miles and keep the vegetation from growing up through it. Down in the southwest, they use electricity for weed control. You go along with big generators on tractors and kill the brush by running electricity through it. And it was suggested to us, but we thought that it would have a harsh effect on anyone sitting on the rails around the curve and also on the signal systems and so on. The reballasting is a possibility, but it becomes extremely expensive. These will be covered again, or in greater detail, and additional alternatives covered as we go forward with the EIS. I had one thing prepared. I'll read if it's... The controversy over herbicides among informed members of the public and scientific communities is not whether herbicides will kill at the touch, but whether years of exposure may cause increases in incidences of some kinds of disease, and not whether spot application or occasional use will cause widespread ecological damage, but whether applying tons of pesticides per square mile for decade after decade will affect the function of some types of soil ecology or cause small amounts of herbicides to appear in groundwater. I'd like to point out that in the lower 48, in the United States in general, about 2.7 billion pounds of pesticides are used each year. In the croplands of the grain basket of the United States, we're using well over a ton per square mile of herbicides. The railroad, in its application, was using on the order of a ton or so for the entire railroad, 600 miles of railroad. when they were using herbicides. This puts things in a little bit of perspective. We're using, say, 10 pounds per square mile, where in the lower 48, we're using a ton or more of herbicide to grow corn or beans or whatever in the Midwest. I'm not suggesting that we should ignore the real problems that can be associated with the improper use of herbicides, but rather that we keep these problems in perspective and that we go to responsible sources for information to answer our questions about these chemicals. We should be suspicious of any person or organization who tries to tell us that herbicides or other pesticides can be applied indiscriminately without consequence, or that the pesticides registered with EPA are automatically safe in any application for which they are registered, or that there is no need to carefully evaluate both the target organisms and other components of the affected environment before herbicides are used. We also should be suspicious of sources that try to tell us that most herbicides are highly toxic, or refer to them as toxic wastes, or call them agent this or agent that to evoke memories of Vietnam, or to suggest that because there were problems with a few herbicides, that all herbicides are unsafe, or that use other rhetorical gimmickry to make herbicides seem more dangerous than they are. Both extremes are misleading. The truth is that we should evaluate all of the alternatives to solve pest control problems on a case-by-case basis, and select the best solution not from prejudice or preconceived notion or unsubstantiated fear, but by looking at the facts, and by using a great mass of information that is available, and by maintaining our objectivity as we decide how to solve these problems. Thank you for allowing me to speak.
Thank you very much. Dr.
Hunt, it's nice to see you, Senators, and ladies and gentlemen. I'm also an alumnus of heart surgery myself. I've had my own heart repaired. I'd like to speak against the use of herbicides and pesticides, and that doesn't mean that I'm speaking for either the herbs or the pests. I'm a believer in the similarity, chemical similarity of people and herbs and pests, and I think whether you're a creationist or an evolutionist, you have to agree that they're all pretty similar, and the closer we come to chemicals that can really have a massive effect on one animal, for example, a pest, the closer we have to worry about, the greater we have to worry about whether that'll have a significant effect on humans. So basically, I'm here today to talk about the effects of these things on humans. That does not mean that I can give you a lot of data. It just means I've thought a lot about it, I've read a lot about it, and just as with the professor of agronomy that presented previously, I'm not personally involved in the research on it. I'd like to say, first of all, that people are all different. People are different when you cut them. Some people bleed a lot, some don't bleed much. Some people respond differently to one thing or another. People have different chemical sensitivities. This LD50 that you've heard referred to refers to how killing off half of a population at a certain dose level. Now, that population, as was stated, is usually an animal population, and killing off half the animal population is a good test of the acute toxicity of substance, although it doesn't really tell you much about what happened to the other animals. And I would, for example, point out that if you were to discuss automobiles and increasing accident rate until half of the people were killed, you would be leaving out a lot of injured, because clearly there's a lot more injury in automobile accidents than there is death, at least around the United States. There's a question of what is good and what is bad as far as vegetation and insects, and we still do not know really enough to discuss that. I think that it's quite clear to most people who thought about it that we're all part of a rather complex environment, and that anything you did to one part of the environment would have impact on other parts. Widespread chemical usage is entirely different from a person destroying a bug in a rose bush, and that's where we do not know really what's happening. If we had a perfect pesticide or a perfect herbicide, something that would eradicate every willow or every aphid that was within a certain range, we can predict what that would do for the environment. Fortunately, probably, we don't have those things. But what we do have is a pesticide or an herbicide that will have significant impact on the critter that's, or the bush that's being aimed at, and some impact on the people that are applying it, who get the highest dose, and some impact on the environment long term, and on the people nearby and those utilizing the vegetation or whatever long term. Now, if anyone says to you that they know what the long-term effects of pesticides or herbicides are, I would suggest to you that they're wrong. And the reason I'd suggest to you that they're wrong is because nothing in use or applied now is in the is being applied and used according to these to local people I've discussed this matter with is being applied and used in the same fashion as it was 20 years ago. Now the reason that you couldn't get an answer to your question, Senator Moss, on what you were spraying on cotton may be that that isn't being used anymore. And the reason it isn't being used anymore would not be something that the chemical company, which is selling billions of tons of chemical around the world, is likely to come up to you and mention to you. It's just going to sort of disappear. And when a chemical just sort of disappears off the marketplace, DDT was pretty well known, and it wasn't really bad for you, although it stayed around forever, and it made bird eggs kind of soft in the shell. But when the chemical is no longer used, and I do not know if that chemical is any longer used, but when some other chemical takes its place, it's either a more profitable chemical or a less dangerous chemical, or maybe the work hasn't been done on it to show what it is. We all know that there's widely, that most of the papers that are referred to by the professor and others are funded by research that's funded by these large chemical companies. And large chemical companies are very sensitive about the research they fund and about the papers that might be published. And I think that's true also of the researcher who wants to continue to get grants. I think that's just an obvious thing, and that we get a lot of phony data. We get a lot of inaccurate, sloppy work. And recently, the EPA released a little thing in the newspaper about a chemical called Lasu Alachlor. And they, if you wish, I could just read the little thing from the Los Angeles Times, which was quoted in our local paper. The Environmental Protection Agency placed new curbs Tuesday on the nation's most widely used agricultural weed killer, Alachlor, stating that recent studies indicate the chemical poses long-term cancer risks for 600,000 farm workers and consumers of farm products. EPA officials said the restrictions would last until further tests, which should take 2 years, determine whether the herbicide poses a significant risk to public health. The restrictions on the herbicide sold under the trade name of Lasu were ordered after laboratory tests showed large continued doses of it caused tumors in laboratory rats and rhesus monkeys. Lasu was used mostly on corn, potato, and soybean crops, but EPA officials said that residues of the chemical could contaminate not only grocery store produce, but also meat and dairy goods from cattle that eat Lasu-treated forage. The EPA had long believed that Lasu posed no cancer risk, but some tests backing that conclusion conducted more than a decade ago were ruled invalid last year after the company that performed them was accused of shoddy laboratory practices and falsifying some data. The same thing is true on both sides of the fence. The people who are doing studies on carbon monoxide effects on hearts and so forth have been found to be phony and up some of the data. There's a Dr. Arnau who gave some of the basic studies on the effects of cigarette gases on people, and that is no longer considered reliable. What I'm saying is that there are various reasons for people to come up with various papers proving various things, and the more outstanding a finding, the more likely you are to get publicity for it, and the more it's in the line with the chemical company's desires, the more likely you are to get further grants. So I do not believe you can really believe everything you hear. Agent Orange, it's interesting that the chemical companies, and I would say they're hard-headed business persons rather than actually soft-hearted folk, have given $160 million to the folks that were exposed to that. Maybe they don't want to discuss what happened to the people in Vietnam. If we're going to start discussing India's exposure of 2,000 people, maybe they don't want to hear about the millions in Vietnam that were exposed. I do not know, but they appear to have good business reasons. The good business reasons are based on the following thing, and that is that there are no long-term reliable studies on the effects of these materials on people. I've had, in my own yard, I've used weed and feed, and that stuff formerly had something in it that was immediately declared bad for you after it had been used for a number of years, and I couldn't even give it back to the nice man that sold it to me because he didn't want it around. I've had two patients at the hospital. When I was a young intern, I had two patients at the hospital who were inadvertently treated to cockroach fumigation, and both died of liver trouble. My wife's stepfather died of liver trouble at an age when he shouldn't have died otherwise because he was in perfect condition, but he loved to kill bugs on his orchids. I have a very close, good friend that has been chronically ill all his life since he used to work heavily in agricultural spraying. In my own past history, for the last 18 years, I've been intermittently sprayed with registered, legitimate, legally procured sprays that were forced upon me by my neighbor. They got a tree line between my neighbor and my house. The neighbor has finally stopped doing that, thanks to some legal activity on my part, but there's very little fallback position that we have, except for a very costly lawsuit with very little likelihood of any financial benefit because we can't show any harm. Yet I could come into this same room if I was a registered sprayer, and I could spray everybody here with a low enough intensity of spray so that they might all feel some slight effect or might not have much effect, and I could continue that daily if I was a registered sprayer and the wind speed was whatever is allowed or whatever within certain restrictions. And what I'm trying to say is that right at the present time there's no limit on what a person can spray on you, although you in turn are not allowed to hit him on the head with a hammer. I have been considering that at times, and one of the times was recently about a year and a half ago when I had my windows and doors open. I was sitting up, and in fact I had been working all night and I was asleep in my bed, and I had doors and windows open, and it was about 10 or 11 in the morning, and it was a lovely day, and the breeze was coming through, and before I knew it I was getting sprayed with something, so I went out and I happened to pick up a hammer on the way out because I thought there might be a loose nail somewhere, and there was a fella spraying the tree line as usual right next to my house, and I was getting a heavy dose of this stuff. I developed at that time, which I'd never had before, chest pain. I contacted various people, Mr. Burgoyne, who's an expert on this, from Palmer and other people, and they did studies that showed I'd probably been sprayed with a couple of different kinds of organophosphates. The person that sprayed me was registered to do that, was doing it within his legal rights, and in fact was back, after, despite some possible disciplinary action, was back in spraying other people soon after. One of the big problems that is facing us is who applies this pesticide locally and who applies the herbicide on the railroad and so forth. I do not know about that specific case, but I will say that I've had people come by what are registered and relatively conservative business licensed type persons who do the pesticide applications year after year. I've had other people that they refer to as fly-by-nights come around the neighborhood, and those people come around their orange truck, and there'll be a fat lady in a Cadillac riding a ways behind them so she didn't get sprayed, and they'll pick up a grand or two in the morning just in my neighborhood telling everybody what a terrible bug they got and it's about to eat them out, and they hand out little cards saying, dangerous work is especially requested because that's our specialty. Well, the kids that are spraying it are just local kids. They're getting $5 or $10 an hour. The stuff's raining down upon them. They have no idea what they're doing. They have no idea of protection. They have no idea of the risks involved, and when I discussed with the man who was trying to sell it to me, he immediately went to the hospital for a blood test. What I'm trying to say is that OSHA has these chemical on the workplace type legislation where you must tell people at your workplace what chemicals they're being exposed to. I do not think this is being done by the pesticide industry, and I do not think that the majority of the people that are working there even have any knowledge or understanding of what they're doing. Now, recently there's become available a pesticide test where you can poke a needle in and get 19 different pesticides analyzed on your fat. Well, why the fat? It turns out that the data, for example, that was referred to, where you get a pesticide in your system, and it's very...